Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Powerful JRE. In this episode, the complexities of fame and reinvention are explored alongside personal stories of recovery. Join for a thought-provoking discussion on comedy, controversy, and the cosmic moments that shape our lives. And now, let's begin.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
Great to finally meet you, man.
It's great to meet you. It's a trip, and you know, walking in, and I'm thinking, how is it possible that our paths didn't cross
all
those years? I mean, it's conceivable we were in the same venue or the same building or at the same party or at
probably
least something.
I kind of avoided parties. I avoid basically everything. I avoided parties. I avoided premieres. Anything where there's a red carpet, like even if I was in a movie, I wouldn't go on the red carpet. I'd go in through the back door.
Seriously?
Yeah, I don't like
it. Wow.
I don't like all that fucking look over here. That is just too fake for me. It just, whatever allergy I have to that flares, and I'm like, I'm going in through the back door. Fuck this.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you.
I don't like it.
I don't blame you. They stopped showing me where the back door was because I support a similar entrance thing.
It's just too weird.
But it's look over here. It's that thing. Something happens in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think it's like it brings you as close to possibly sterilization as you can get without, you know, surgery.
I think it's bad for you.
Yeah.
I think it's I think it's like radiation.
Yeah.
Like you could take a little bit of it, but, you know, you don't want to be working the X-ray machine your whole life.
No. No, and then there's always that one lady who keeps calling you back to her.
Right. Charlie.
Right. Far left.
Yeah.
And you've looked at her like 7 times already. Mm-hmm. And then I'm out there thinking, if it took me this many takes to get a scene right, nobody would ever hire me.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get past the first day.
Well, they want to get a million pictures just to get that perfect one where there's a little bit of side eye to you, just a little something.
Right.
A little purse of the lips, a little something.
The one that kind of like you're
one.
Responding to something.
Yeah,
someone
that's the
kind of,
one.
Yeah. But then they choose. Which one do they always choose? The one that's absolute dog shit.
Yeah, the one with your mouth open.
Exactly.
Or your eyes closed.
Yeah, yeah.
What I really don't like is the people who like it. Not that I don't like them, is that I don't want to ever see that in myself. And so when I'd be around them, I would just go, oh, I got to get out of here.
Right.
Freak me out. The trappings.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is there, because it feels like that system's been in place for over 100 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there another way to do it?
Probably not.
No?
People like it. You know, photographers like it, the press likes it, it's a big thing. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of lights flashing, it seems legit.
Right.
Yeah.
I just, I can never feel relaxed when everybody's yelling.
Right.
You know, it's
totally unnatural.
It's completely unnatural.
The only way that would be happening in real life is if, like, you were on trial. You know, like you were being paraded in front of a bunch of people. It's him. There he is. Look over here. You know, it's odd. It's very odd.
Yeah. It's a form of a perp walk, isn't it?
A little bit of a perp walk and just a little bit of a mental illness exhibition.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I just had it for the first time, last Thursday.
The first time ever?
No, for the first time in like
a long time.
In like maybe over a decade. At the Netflix premiere for the doc.
Yeah.
And it was kind of cool. Like the first, you know, 34 seconds. I was like, okay, I remember this. And then it was like, I fucking remember this.
Yeah.
Wow. Damn. And then I'm in the sun just beating right on my uh-huh. forehead. And it's just, I could feel myself start to sweat. Now I'm questioning the whole outfit, you know, the underwear choice, all of it. It's just like every decision I made leading up to that was completely wrong.
Yeah.
And it's all being documented, you know.
Oh, it's so odd. Yeah. What's really funny, when you first walked into the studio, you brought up a tweet that I had sent in 2011. I think this is when you were going crazy.
Yeah.
And I think this is also when my friend Russell Peters was doing those tours with you.
Oh, that's right.
And it said, I need to get Charlie Sheen on my podcast. I know it's a long shot, but a boy can dream. If anybody knows him, help me hook it up. Well, here we are, 14 years later.
Yeah, you know, it takes what it takes, right?
Yeah. It's funny because back then, I don't think I had no guests. I think I had Anthony Bourdain was the only like real guest that I had had.
Seriously?
By the time. Yeah, he was 2011 as well.
And how many shows had you done by then?
Not that many by then. I don't know.
So were you just doing solo shows, just like covering topics?
I would
and
do it mostly with my friends, mostly with other comics.
Okay.
We would just sit and talk shit, and then eventually.
At like your house? Or?
Yeah, it was at my house back then. Okay. Yeah.
So then, it looked nothing like this.
No, no, no. It slowly had to get out. It's like I had too many weirdos that I had to bring by my house, and I have young kids at the time. They were really young. I was like, this is just too strange. Wow. Bring these weirdos by my house. And, you know, it was just too odd. I was like, maybe some people shouldn't know exactly where I sleep.
Right, right. Yeah. And it's interesting because driving here, I was buried in my phone just, you know, for the right reasons. So I have no idea where we are.
Good.
So it was kind of like a version of being blindfolded with a sack over my head, you know?
Yeah, that's probably how we should do it.
Can you imagine then, like, I'm the guy they're blaming for introducing this?
Just put everybody in a blindfold and put them in the back of an SUV and drive them to an undisclosed location.
And make the guy drive a few circles around in, like, some, you know, neighborhood right over there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we did it. We're here. Those things that you did with Russell Peters were so fascinating. The whole thing was so fascinating. I watched the Netflix thing. I watched the first episode. And the whole experience of watching the guy from Platoon, the guy that everybody knows is like this gigantic, super cool movie star, hot shots, all these different things, to watch you just not just go off the rails with drugs, but like be super open about it. You were like the first guy super open about it, you know, and everybody just embraced it. Instead of it being like, oh, Charlie Sheen's doing drugs, that's so sad. It was like, we love him.
Keep going.
It was kind of crazy.
Keep going.
The Tiger Blood stuff and winning. Everybody was saying winning all the time. And what was that like for you? Was it the worst kind of reinforcement? Were you surprised by it?
That's a great way to describe it. The worst kind of reinforcement.
Yeah.
It was like unintentionally or otherwise celebrating a guy's demise.
Having delved into the complexities of celebrity culture and its consequences, the conversation shifts to the intriguing evolution of memory in our digital age as we explore how technology reshapes our recollections.
And now from now on, every time you want a memory, you can go just like, you know, you look on your phone, like your iPhone on this day in 2017, you're like, oh, look at us. Oh, that's cool. You're going to be able to do that in your brain, you know, and the way that we're going to buy into it is because our memory sucks.
That's how they're going to sell it to us.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember your phone number when you were a kid?
No, but I remember my address because it rhymed.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was 7212 Birdview Avenue, Malibu.
Well, you used to remember your phone number. What happened? It goes away because your memory sucks.
Right. I know my parents' number because they still have a landline.
Oh, they're still rocking the landline.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, and they have an answering machine.
Whoa.
Yeah, but during dinner, they haven't really turned it
down. Oh, and then people start talking in the background?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just part of it. It's part of the experience.
They're rocking a landline with an answering machine in 2025. Yeah. That is.
Yeah.
It's probably the way to do it. I used to love the answering machine. Would you come home, the light would be flashing like someone likes me.
Right.
Somebody called.
Yeah.
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 It was cool. It was like you had a dog coming home to wait, like to visit you when you came home. Like, oh, look.
It's like in Deuce Bigelow when it's like he's at his lowest point. The thing in the light is never blinking.
I forgot about that.
You have no new messages.
Yeah, that was a wild time where you could get phone calls. That's the other thing is like you got famous before the internet too, which is a different world. It's a different world because there's not that many of you. There's way less famous people. There's way more famous people now.
Yeah.
You got famous, like super duper famous at 21 years old with no internet.
Trip out, yeah, I know.
How does anybody expect you to come out normal? Jesus Christ.
And you try, you can't really even explain to someone that wasn't around during all that. You can't really explain what it felt like, because they look at it as the things that were missing. And there wasn't anything missing.
Right,
you
right.
Know, it was about having to really be engaged in everything you were doing. You know, you had to show up to gain, to get a like. You had to enter the building.
Right. You know,
you had to go to on a talk show. You had to attend a junket. You know what I'm saying? And you mm-hmm. could, and nobody knew what the behind the scenes of your movie looked like until, you know, years later on the DVD feature or the VHS feature.
Right.
That they finally saw some of that stuff.
You know?
It wasn't all access 24/7. 365.
You know? And for some people, they can't leave it alone. They have to live stream during the day. They're live streaming from their trailer. They're live streaming in their car on the way home. They're like,
yeah, what is that about?
They're nuts. They're just locked into this weird new world that we're living in.
But is it because there's genuinely people that are tuning in with enthusiasm that are looking forward to that live stream in the car ride home? Or because the person, or is it a combination?
I think it's those things, and it's also that thing that you said that you didn't ever get, they're scared of. You didn't ever get alone time. Mm. Just time to decompress and think. Just be by yourself. No phone, no TV. Just fucking sit on the couch and just like catch your breath.
Right.
And they don't want that. They're scared of that. So they're just constantly engaged with something.
I like entire days of that.
Ooh, that's nice.
Alone on the couch.
Yeah.
Watching TV.
That's nice. It's nice to just shut off, right? It really is. It's all work, no play. Not good.
Not good at all.
Not good.
No.
Bad for you. And bad for your work, too, because it makes you just kind of, it gets dreary. You don't have the same enthusiasm for it anymore. You know, it's like you need discipline, but you also need enthusiasm.
You know what I was going to say earlier? Thanks. Okay. All right. The memory just, you know, dropped another token in the in the slot. Now it's, you know, it doesn't even connect.
It doesn't? Let's find out.
Well, no. Then I actually forgot it again. How about that? Is that fucking nuts?
It's normal. It's normal. When you first got Platoon, did you have any idea like what the fuck was going to happen?
I didn't.
Is that for people today to understand how big that movie was? Because it was one of the very first realistic war movies, and I think very importantly, it was done by Oliver Stone, who was actually a veteran of the Vietnam War. You remembering what you wrote down?
Just that piece. Yeah, I'm not going to forget it again.
Okay.
Pardon. Sorry.
But that it was a different kind of war movie, you know.
Yeah, it
much in the lines of your dad's movie.
Yeah,
you know, and that was a very different kind of war movie as well.
Yeah, Apocalypse from Here, Platoon, you know, boots on the ground. The script didn't read like it was going to be a masterpiece. The script read. Like a kind of like a docudrama sort of movie of the week. It didn't read that script and say, oh wow, okay, yeah, this is the one. People are gonna really they're gonna worship this thing. The dialogue was very clipped and very specific. You kind of never really knew where you were in the script, in the scene descriptions. You know, the script was so lean. I think it was like barely 100 pages.
Really?
Yeah. So I didn't realize sort of what we were doing until we were actually doing it. Usually I can read a scene and get a sense of, you know, what my responsibilities are going to be or how we're going to break it down, or at least, you know, how I'm going to see it on the screen. And I couldn't do that with Platoon, because all the terrain, all the scenes, everything kind of felt very similar, you know?
Really?
And the original title was The Platoon.
Mm.
You think it's as big a hit if he keeps the?
Yeah, I don't think it matters. It's a great movie.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's a great movie. It doesn't matter.
But we started to feel it as we got deeper into it. And Oliver did something brilliant where he decided to film it in continuity. Like from page one, day one, all the way to the final day was the final page. And that gave us a chance to, like, when something was finished, you were done with it. And you didn't have to know how you were going to react or how you already reacted to something that hadn't happened yet.
Right.
And when people died in the movie, they got sent home. Mm. So they were just, like, the next day, they were just gone. I guess he wanted us to feel that sense of just someone gone, that loss, that you know, sadness.
Having delved into the emotional weight of loss in film, the conversation shifts dramatically to the complexities surrounding historical events as they unravel the layers of conspiracy and intrigue.
It's gruesome. Yeah, I mean, I think he was shot from multiple angles simultaneously. That's what I think. I think he was shot both from the back and from the front. And I think Lee Harvey Oswald, if he wasn't involved, he certainly wasn't innocent. He was probably the guy that they were going to frame it on.
Right.
But I think he was in on the whole thing. Anyway, I think he killed a cop afterwards as well.
Tippett? No.
Yeah, Tippett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever read that thing about, because Tippett's nickname back at the precinct was JFK? Did you ever read this thing? Then they show the side-by-side of how much they really look like each other.
Oh, really?
So they're saying he was the body they used for the transfer when they flew with the empty coffin, you know, all that stuff.
Oh, about, God.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it is so... there's so many just, you know, warrens to travel down.
Yeah.
And there's so many angles to explore.
There's too many. There's so many rabbit holes to go down.
We were introduced to it as kids. Because Dad played both Kennedys. So we were seeing documentaries at, like, you know, I would have been 10 or 11. Emilio was 13 or 14. And so we've been involved in this thing for a lot longer than we should have been.
Wow.
Yeah. We had access to this stuff. And so...
It was just nuts that no one was brought to justice. And we know for sure more people were involved than Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald. There was more people involved and no one was brought to justice and they got away with it. We don't want to think that they get away with things like killing the president, but they did.
In broad daylight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And blaming it on a lone gunman, a lone nut.
Yeah. Yeah. Who they already had a full description and rap sheet and rundown and everything about.
Oh, they knew everything about him. They printed articles about him before it was even over.
Yeah.
And then the Jack Ruby thing, where Jack Ruby goes completely insane in jail after he's visited by Jolly West, who is the head of MK Ultra, who is, like, routinely dosing people with acid.
Yeah.
Jolly West cooked Jack Ruby's brain in jail and just left him insane.
He's the guy from, what's the book that it's
Chaos.
From Chaos. Yeah. I actually read Chaos before it got all the attention.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of mine gave it to me, and I'll read a couple pages, and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is one of the best books.
This is a different take.
Yeah.
But I'm curious how you felt about the documentary they did about it.
I didn't watch it.
Okay. I
thought it was going to be too quick. 90 minutes, I didn't think was like enough time. It's only 90 minutes, right?
I thought it was the first episode.
So I watched it
sort of like a data gathering thing that you usually do with the first episode and kind of just seeing what the director's doing and what kind of stuff they're laying out early.
Yeah.
So, and then when it ended and I didn't see that second episode with the timer, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was, I thought it was a complete, I thought it radically underserved the book.
Yeah, maybe they could try again. That needs to be like an 8-part, 2-hour-a-piece series.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, because it's so nuts. The story is so nuts.
Yeah.
Just the provable actual facts are so nuts
that
very likely Charles Manson was a CIA asset. Very likely they had groomed him when he was in prison and taught him mind control techniques when people were high on acid, taught him how to be sober but pretend he's on acid, and how to interact with these people that are on acid and shape their mind and even get them to commit murder, all of which is fact.
Yeah, no, it's I would say it's insane, but so much of it is, I don't want to say provable, but has enough supporting evidence to make a compelling case. And I love that the guy starts out just like a, you know, just a kind of a normal celebrity assignment for mm-hmm. Premier Magazine, right? Yep. Yeah, I've been on that magazine. I had that cover twice. My story didn't wind up like that.
I think that it was a story for a magazine, and it was just about the anniversary of the murders.
Exactly.
That's it.
That's what it was, yeah.
You know, just give us a piece, you know, so people go, wow, crazy, 25 years later, wow.
Right, yeah.
And then he gets obsessed, and he starts realizing, well, this guy was full of shit, and that guy was corrupted.
Right.
Oh, my God, look at this. And hold on. Who's Jolly West?
Right,
you know, like, what's
right.
MK Ultra? This is real Freedom of Information Act. You get the documents. Oh, my God. Operation Midnight Climax. The government was running whorehouses? They were running whorehouses and using two-way mirrors and dosing Johns and filming them? And this has to do with Manson? Like, what the fuck was going on?
Yeah.
And then you realize that it was all a psyop to try to demonize the peace, love, and stop war movement. And that what they really wanted to do was stop the anti-war movement and do something to curb the cultural change that was happening. And so their strategy was to turn hippies into murderers.
It kind of worked.
It kind of worked.
Yeah.
It kind of worked.
Yeah. I mean, it's a long way to go, but it I think it had the effect they were looking for.
Imagine if they didn't do that. Like, what kind of cultural change would have taken place? Because if you think about what happened between 1950 and 1960? It's like the world becomes a different place in 10 years. Between 1960 and 1970, it's like, what? This world is crazy. The music is crazy. The culture is crazy. The movies are nuts. Everything is wild. It's very psychedelic. And then Nixon comes along in 1970, passes this sweeping Schedule I Act, makes all mushrooms and LSD, makes everything illegal, all to stop the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement at the same time when they're doing this Manson stuff. So it was a concerted effort across the board to stop the anti-war movement and to stop the civil rights movement. They were like, we're losing control and power. And so, I mean, it was an evil thing to do, but you kind of got to give them credit because it was pretty brilliant. Like, they actually pulled it off. You think of serial killer, you think of Manson. You think of the family. Oh, my God, these hippies are murderous.
Right.
They're a bunch of murderous freaks on drugs, cutting women's babies out of their stomachs and writing pig on the wall. Like, this is nuts.
Yeah, and they brought the Beatles into it.
And our own goddamn government engineered it. They stopped what was probably one of the most beautiful cultural shifts in this country's history.
That would have organically still kept evolving into other things that would have blossomed out of it.
We probably would have rethought government. We probably would have like rethought the type of people that we want as leaders. We'd have rethought our involvement in foreign wars. There would have been no support for it. We would have rethought what psychedelic drugs can do for you versus the bad aspects of them. We would have rethought everything. The music would have been a lot better.
Having delved into the chaotic influence of cultural shifts and government control, the conversation now pivots to the unexpected realities of personal freedom and responsibility. As the discussion unfolds around the complexities of power.
But if you open up a free clinic, you're going to get enough, you know, lost children that come in through your doors.
Well, they're going to need your legit services to start with. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You got to sort it out.
Right. Right. You know? Yeah.
It's just nuts that's our government. That's our daddies. Our government daddies, the people that we're supposed to be looking to help us lead a prosperous life and secure our standing in the world and make sure we grow financially. And these motherfuckers did all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, ultimate power, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In any form. Well, they're bringing it back to stardom. Like, that's a weird power to give somebody. It's especially when you're 21 years old. Like
stardom.
A weird power. Weird amount of freedom. Weird amount of, like, people expecting you to be kind of wild.
Sure. Yeah, and again, that thing you talked about where you watch it happen to others and then suddenly it's you. It's a lot more intoxicating. And then I would always think, okay, so why, how were they able to control it? Why didn't I see them enjoying it at this level? And it wasn't about, I'm going to show them the way they should have been doing it. It was just about, hey guys, okay, cool. No, it finally made its way over here, and it can go to 11, you know, and not burn the whole house down, you know, when it was still fun, when it was still creative and productive on some level, you know, because it wasn't about, it was still having to show up. And it was still, you know, carving out enough time for the party, but also reserving enough, you know, energy for the job.
Right.
You know,
that's the balance. And yeah. Some people can pull it off. Some people, they're really sure. Disciplined and they pull off the work and then they pull off the partying.
Right. Right. And I was able to maintain that for a long time. You know, and even when it flamed out, like those early rehabs, and there was always like there was a job, like the day I got out.
Wow.
You know, scripts showing up in rehab, and it's like they want you to get well, kid. They want you to get better, but you know, as soon as you're out of here, you know, we got some good stuff for you to look at.
There's also, unfortunately, a romantic notion of a guy getting out of rehab.
Interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
How many cop shows start with a guy who's down on his dumps, putting a pizza in a blender for breakfast?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like really right. Like at his lowest of low points.
Right.
Drinking, and then maybe his daughter cries and he throws the bottles into the trash can and is like, oh, I'm done. And right. Now he's back. And there's a romantic thing of getting your shit together.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, Charlie's back. Yeah. Better than ever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it's you know, everybody's rooting for you again.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and they're expecting the guy to deliver.
Yeah, with
again,
passion now,
with passion.
Real life experience. He was a drug addict.
Exactly. Yeah.
Look at Robert Downey Jr. now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
People love that. They love that.
But the same thing was happening to Downey when he was in rehab, or maybe when he was even in the pen, when they people were bringing him. I think they brought him Ally McBeal when he was still in jail.
Oh.
And I think he still got high after that.
Mm.
You know, and my dad would always be like yelling at the television. It's like, stop rewarding this behavior. Stop rewarding it. Let him sit in those consequences. Not out of judgment right. Or out of punishment, or you know, just out of love. You know,
to help him get his shit together.
Yeah.
If you keep letting them fuck up over and over again, they'll continue to fuck up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if there's always a carrot the day you walk out, you know, something to chase, and a soft landing.
Yeah.
You know, that's what was really interesting about this, you know, this decade long timeout that I got put into, you know, which, you know, at some point the punishment has to just sort of fit the crime. Right. It felt like it was a little bit longer than it should have been. Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember any murder charges, you know. But at the same time, there's not a chance that I could have done the two projects the book came out yesterday and the doc comes out today, you know, I couldn't have done either unless I had the kind of perspective and distance from all of that I was able to find, you know.
You've been sober for how long? 7 years?
Coming up on eight. Yeah.
8 years.
Yeah, I'll be eight in December.
That probably helped a lot to be away from everything for you to achieve that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was still doing things to, you know, just kind of stay in the mix a little bit. And, you know, I do signings, I do speaking engagements, do stuff like that. But it was also like, it's like as soon as I quit drinking, all my kids started showing up again. And you know, Sam and Lola were living there, and then they'd cycle back with Denise, and then Bob and Max would show up, and then Brooke would come back, and like, okay, so he's gonna be here, and then Lola would show back up. So my house was kind of like this. It was like a clubhouse, you know. And I write in the book that my vacancy sign, you know, for those children always hangs facing out, you know. So it was. you know, being called to a much more responsible and complicated set of responsibilities and order, you know, and just having to do stuff that they didn't care about, you know, a rating of a show or response to a movie or any like popularity or IMDb, you know, stuff. They were just like, you know, with the basic needs and getting to school and help with this. And so it was really cool to like suddenly just be that's the only stuff that mattered to the people that matter the most.
Mm.
And so, but you're right that none of that could have happened if I was away on location or having to be at a studio
right.
every week or,
right.
but, yeah, I think it was about the time that it created, you know? So, and it's interesting that I'm not looking at this as a comeback, you know. I think it's a reset.
Having navigated the challenges of responsible choices, the narrative shifts to the unexpected journey of a struggling performer, revealing how a name change transformed his career and identity in the world of comedy.
His one point forming as a singing waiter until he was fired before taking a job selling aluminum siding in the mid-50s to support his wife and family. He later quipped, so in the 1960s, he started reviving his career.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So somewhere close to 10 years. Still working as a salesman by day, he returned to the stage performing at hotels in the Catskills Mountains, but still finding minimal success. He fell into debt, about $20,000 by his own estimate, couldn't get booked. Dangerfield came to realize what he lacked was an image, a well-defined on-stage persona that the audience could relate to, one that would distinguish him from other comics. After being shunned by some premier comedy venues, he returned home where he began developing a character for whom nothing goes right. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Wow.
Damn.
Oh, look at this. During Roy's comeback bid, who's Roy?
When he was 19, he was Jack Roy.
Oh!
So he had to change his name. He had to become Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh!
People are recognizing
him.
I'm going to use that checking in at hotels from now on.
Wanting to distinguish himself from longtime patrons who might have remembered him from the 1940s, Roy asked club owner George McFadden to change his name. He came up with Rodney Dangerfield. Wow, he didn't want people to remember him as Jack Roy from back in the day. He didn't like his old act.
Wow.
Wow. He said, I don't know where it came from. McFadden may have taken it from the Jack Benny program on NBC Radio, which first used Rodney Dangerfield as a character's name in 1941. Ricky Nelson also used the pseudonym in a 1962 episode of The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. Wow.
Huh.
That's crazy.
Sullivan Show, 1967.
Wow. That's when he popped again.
That's amazing.
That's nuts.
Wow. Go get him.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't know whether to start a parade or start a war.
He was a fun guy. I knew a lot of people who knew him. I didn't get a chance to meet him. I saw him once at the Laugh Factor. I ran into him. I said hi, but that was it. I never really got a chance to talk to him.
So you did have a moment.
I had a moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was just leaving the stage. He was outside,
awesome.
He had some
thank you.
Hot MILF with him.
Awesome, thank you.
I was like, you go, Rodney.
Why not? Why not?
I think it was probably his wife. His wife is who donated us these handwritten notes and also the photograph of him, too. It's pretty cool. It's just there's a few guys like that, you know, without them, you always wonder, like, where would comedy be? Like, where would it ever turn up? Like, so many people, like Pryor and him and Lenny Bruce, so many people that just, like, changed everything.
Carlin.
Yeah. So many people just changed. Kinison.
Sure.
They just changed the whole thing. But Dangerfield was one of the rare ones that introduced new comics to people. Like, that's where everybody found out about Kinison. That's where everybody found out about Dice Clay, Don Marrera, Lenny Clark. All these guys, Robert Schimmel, they all started out on the Rodney Dangerfield HBO comedy specials.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he would have, like,
he would, like, have his favorite comedians.
Oh,
he would just have, like, a show where he would, like, introduce his favorite comedians.
But he'd have to scout them at the clubs?
Yep. He would go see them.
So he'd just go out?
And he had his own club in New York City, Dangerfield's.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
But he was, you know, he was interested in promoting comedy too. You know, just a fucking amazing guy. That's such a cool moment you had with him.
I can see it. I mean, it's like there's nothing tricky about that memory. You know,
what was it like being with your dad while he was filming Apocalypse Now?
It was a lot of that in the book.
How old were you?
I went there as a 10-year-old.
Whoa.
I had my 11th birthday there. Spent a combined total of 8 or 9 months there, and that was going back and forth. You know, it wasn't just another country; it was another planet.
Mm.
You know, we'd seen, you know, different parts of the world traveling with him. You know, Mexico, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, places like that, you know. But then you get to the Philippines, and it was just, you just got a sense that, this is all going on at the same time that we've been in Malibu, like,
right,
kind of, you know, having fun and just doing cool shit. And so you visit a place like that and get in the middle of it and engage in this entirely just a new, such a surreal reality. And then, oh, wait a minute, they're here to make a movie, and it's about a film that it's about a war that barely ended like a year ago. Right.
Yeah.
14 months ago. When did Saigon fall? It was 75.
Mm,
right?
I think so.
Yeah, and I mean, it was like right at the tail end of it. And so, yeah, it was, we were able to do enough stuff like recreationally, you know, there was a lake and you could water ski, you could fish, you could do those kind of things if you didn't want to go to the set with Dad. But once you went and saw the set where Dad was, you didn't give a fuck about water sports or fish or anything, because what they'd built and what they were trying to create was mind-blowing. Because, you know, Coppola built Kurt's compound out of practical materials. It wasn't like, you know, like plaster-covered chicken wire and rebar. These were like, you know, 2-ton boulders.
Yeah.
They brought in and started stacking in the jungle. And then a lot of it would start sinking. Couldn't build a foundation in a riverbank, right?
Right.
But then just the mix of people and the talent and Dennis Hopper and Brando and Duvall every day felt completely unique. You'd go to the set and you were going to see something completely different than what you saw the day before. It was wild.
Wow.
Yeah, and I gravitated towards this gentleman named Fred Blau, who I mentioned in the book. He was the key makeup artist, you know, FX guy, and so he was building all the prosthetics for all the carnage you see in the movie. You know, so I'd walk into his shop and there'd just be arms and legs and heads, but I knew it was all fake, you know.
Yeah.
So as a 10-year-old, when you start seeing how it's made and you know, so gore, I think I write in the book, was never gore in movies was never emotional. It was technical.
Hmm.
You know, but still kept me really curious about how it was done and just the artisans behind it that could create those effects.
Having delved into the artistry behind cinematic effects, the conversation shifts to a different kind of tension. As negotiations for a major contract unfold, revealing the complexities of legacy and personal choice.
Quick little
tune-up.
Like a spin drive, whatever they call
that.
And I got the call, we want to renegotiate the giant contract for season 8 and 9, you know? And I was on the phone, I said, I don't think so. And they're like, "What? You don't think you're going to get paid?" I'm like, "No, I don't think we should do it. I'm not. I think 7 is like, you know, Mantle War 7, some other cool 7s. You know, I think 7 is like plenty. I think we've told all the stories that we can mine from that from that Malibu house on the beach with those people. And they're like, no, no, you don't understand, man. This is when it all, like, this is when it turns into like a legacy play for your fucking kids and their kids and that, and then the part they always leave out is and our cut.
Yeah.
And our fucking cut.
Yeah, that's the big part.
Yeah.
That's
and
why
I,
they're on the
and,
phone.
Yeah. And I sat on the phone. And Mark and I have talked about that. I talked to, you know, Mark Berg, my manager. And I said, Mark, if I go back there, man, it's going to go really fucking bad. I just know it. He's like, well, you're projecting that. I said, I'm not projecting shit, man. I'm just smart enough to know how I feel about it now. I got a little bit of clarity in this month I'm in the thing. And I said, if I go back there, I got a bad feeling, Mark.
Why going back to work would send you off the rails?
Just that I had run up against a thing that I had lost passion for the show. I'd lost passion for the process.
Okay, so that if you went and just did it just for the money, you would find some ways to stimulate yourself.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I would have to do something to enhance.
I said that about a lot of guys that got caught on shows that sucked. I knew a lot of guys who got caught on shows where they were getting paid, but they did not like the show. Right. And it was like a bad sitcom.
Right.
And those guys all went crazy. Those guys all started doing a lot of drugs, or they started spending too much money or something. They
right.
did something to distract themselves.
Right.
Because they did not like what they were doing. And they didn't feel satisfied.
Right.
Yeah, but they were getting so much money.
Right.
That they're like, what am I going to do? I'm getting $100,000 a week. I'm like, right. Oh, God.
Yeah.
What do you do? You can't quit.
I was making $54,000 an hour. That's pre-taxes, so was I.
And
I was
you said like, no to season 8 and 9. I'd be like, do I have to wear a dress?
Right? Well, I'll wear,
like, what do I have to do?
I wore Dangerfield's robe at that point.
Yeah, really, let's go.
No, but that was after I got kind of crowbarred into it, you know?
Right.
Well, not crowbarred. I had to ultimately say yes. I got to own that, you know?
Yeah.
But it was just, I was just the wrong guy in that moment, in that pocket of time to, like, give that much fucking money to, man.
Right.
You know?
Right, right, right.
And, like, I'd buy a bunch of cars and then invite a bunch of girls over and then just say, pick one.
And then you did that other thing where you had that other show after that that you got paid, like, a ton of money in advance for, right?
You're talking about Anger Management?
Yes.
No, I was supposed to get, it was called a 1090.
Yeah, it was
how they suck you into that is they say, look, you're not going to get a ton on the front side, but you're going to be, you're going to own a third of the show. You're like 37, 38% of the show in perpetuity. So we're going to do 100 episodes, and it's the South Park model. That was the first 1090 that really just blew it up, and everybody got fucking rich. So you do these 10 episodes. You do a 10-episode pilot. And then if you hit, if the average number of those 10 episodes comes in at, like, I don't know, at like a above a 4 or like a 5.1 or something, that it's like a share, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it activates the next 90. And so then you're doing those 90 to have a sellable syndication package that will just go all over the world and you know, do what syndicated sitcoms do. And so you've done it, you know, and you know, when you say not a lot on the front side, you're still, you know, still getting $1.50 an app, you know, 200, that's pretty good money, right? But it's not, but you kind of eat it on that side, knowing that it's an investment for
right.
the other thing to pay gangbusters.
So
you know?
you did the 10 episodes and then you got to do all of them.
Yes.
So you wound up doing 100.
Yes.
But you did them in a short period of time,
two
right?
and a half years.
That's crazy.
I know. Yeah.
That's
and
crazy.
I was not ready to go back to work.
Whew.
Yeah. And that's the thing I talk about in the book. The only reason I did was because I wanted to show those guys across town that I was
right.
hireable again, you know?
Right, right, right.
And that is not any way to, any mindset to, like, lead the troops. You know? And it, you know, again, it started pretty cool. I did the 10. I was great, you know, doing some pretty good work. And the shows were smart and funny. And then we got into that 90, and it was about 20. No, what am I saying? It's probably like 9 or 11 into it. I started feeling exactly the same shit that I felt
on Two and a Half Men.
Going past that point, I knew my enthusiasm and passion had a had an expiration date.
You couldn't manufacture it?
I tried, but I couldn't. I didn't like the show enough. You know, I loved the people I was working with. You know, from the writers, the crew, to the actors, they were terrific.
You didn't like the final product?
I didn't. Yeah, and I didn't. I stopped caring. But I still, you know, had enough dough to keep the lifestyle and all that other fun shit going on, and just stayed way too fucking high to really engage in this thing. I mean, I was doing this thing, Joe, where I was partying, you know, hitting the fucking pipe, either girls or porn or both or whoever showed up. Yeah, fucking, yeah, hey, come on in. Come on in. There's plenty to go around. And then there's this thing. I think I felt like I was time traveling from like 1 a.m. to like 7. Felt like 11, I don't know, 15 minutes. Whereas, you know, 9 to midnight felt normal. Wow, we had plenty of time to do everything. And then, like, the hours I really needed to, like, you know, settle in and enjoy, those just vanished.
And then you're back to work.
No, I got someone banging on my fucking door. Dude, you're late. What the fuck? And I'm still fucking sideways.
Wow.
So I'd pop a couple of shots or, like, half a Xanax or something, and I said, all right, I just need... And I would literally do this thing. It was a 15-minute, 20-minute nap where I would just hit the pillow. I'd try to meditate with a body just vibrating from crack all night. Trying to meditate?
Wow.
At that point, I'm trying to fucking time travel. I'm trying to levitate, right?
Having navigated the chaotic whirlwind of late night escapades, the conversation shifts to a whirlwind tour of 21 cities in just 24 days. Diving into the unexpected moments that unfolded along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was essentially, it was 21 cities in like 24 days with no act. That's what it was, man.
So who? I know you had Jeff Ross was on something.
Jeff Ross, yeah,
who's great at that. Yeah. The master at off the cuff.
Wow, he showed up and really.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Just put he
perfect
put
a, guy for
he
that.
Put a shape on it.
Yes, and then you had Russell on some of them too, right?
Yes,
who's also a master at off the cuff.
Yes, and yeah. he was so relieved that the two chairs had shown up, because that's when he joined us in Canada. Yeah. No, he was terrific.
Yeah,
he
Russell's awesome.
Yeah. You know, the first night sitting with him, some dude, like, what's like the Canadian version of like a quarter? What's their
a
dollar?
Loony.
A loony. Okay. Yeah. But that's a dollar?
I think so.
Okay. Is that the heavy one?
Yeah, someone threw it at him?
No, at me.
Oh.
Like, we're in the chair for maybe 5 minutes, and I get from the balcony, I get hit with one right here.
Oh.
And it just... It was like getting punched by like someone with a skinny metal hand, you know? And I just had to, kind of pause into that. And they got the guy thrown out. But I just thought, wow, I could have lost an eye.
Yeah.
Russell could have lost an eye. And it was just like, wow, all right. That's
also, pretty good shot.
Really good shot.
Guy throws a loony from the balcony and hits it in the head.
That's
impressive.
It is.
Because that's not an aerodynamic thing.
It's not.
You know,
how you throwing you, that? You have to kind of factor in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of flipping in the air.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like a boomerang or
something.
Yeah.
It's
a
frisbee.
It's a frisbee.
A little tiny frisbee.
Yeah. So anyway, there were just moments like that I guess just little cosmic reminders that not everybody was on my side.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, which is important, too.
Hey, can I hit the bathroom really
quickly?
Yeah.
We can actually wrap it up. We're getting close.
Okay.
You want to wrap it up?
Can we just touch on a couple things before we do?
Absolutely.
Is that cool?
Let's take a leak and we'll come back.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Should we bring this up? I guess we have to. So this just happened. We just found out that Charlie Kirk got shot.
It's fucking awful.
And is he dead?
That's what was just
one of the guys out there just said it was confirmed that he's dead.
In the lobby was just.
I've been looking. I haven't seen anything that said confirmed.
Whoa.
Murder for having a different opinion from somebody else.
Yeah.
Different ideology from somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Beliefs that didn't
who
align.
Did it or,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Dead?
Rest in peace.
Or
fuck.
Fox News.
Jesus. 27 years old, maybe? 30?
Do they even have a suspect?
I don't know. I'm literally trying to track it all on Twitter, and it's all...
Fuck. Nobody deserves it. He doesn't deserve that. Nobody deserves that.
So were you saying that MSNBC had a crazy take on it?
Mm-hmm.
What was their take?
I mean, I'm literally just reading Twitter, so I didn't see the video. I just saw people talking about tweets of it. I'll pull it up, though. Let me see.
Fuck.
And even now, they could have taken it down.
It was a tweet or a video?
I'm doing the show while I'm trying to figure
right,
out.
Right, no, I understand.
I think they were live on the air and people clipped what they were talking about. It's not a tweet, it's not on their Twitter account or anything.
So it's someone's hot take.
I think so. Live in the moment.
Yeah, that's a crazy take. Crazy take is that, what was the take that they deserved
it? I that's why I didn't want to pair.
Right.
Dave Portnoy reposted this.
You found it? All right, here. Put it.
It's only 10 seconds.
Which a shooting like this happens.
You can put the headphones on. You can hear
it. Yeah, and again, I emphasize what you just emphasized. We don't know any of the full details of this. That we don't know if this was a supporter shooting their gun off in celebration, or so we have no idea. But
That's what the crazy thing was.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, if it was a supporter shooting their gun off in celebration.
What? Someone shot their gun off in celebration and killed him.
You shoot celebration guns in the air.
Oh, God.
Just...
what a crazy take. Like, it might not have been someone assassinating someone for the wrong opinion.
Huh.
Fuck.
Why does something like that have to be spun?
Their ideology.
No, I know, but I'm just saying it's like...
I mean, they want to try to pin it on a Trump supporter with a crazy Trump supporter with a gun.
Right.
Going wacky.
Of course.
We don't know if it was a supporter shooting off a gun in celebration. Because you know they do.
Right,
that.
Right, right.
A lot of folks are just constantly out there shooting off guns at large gatherings in celebration.
Yeah, 4th of July, you can't leave your house. You
what the fuck?
No, that is... that's a... Wow.
There's going to be a lot of people celebrating this. It's so scary. It's so dangerous to celebrate or to in any way encourage this kind of behavior from human beings. He's not a violent guy. He's talking to people on college campuses. Wasn't even particularly rude. He's tried to be pretty reasonable with people.
Everything I saw seemed reasonable.
He's a very intelligent guy.
Yeah.
You know, whether you agree with him or don't. And there's a lot of stuff that I didn't agree with him on. That's fine. You're allowed to disagree with people without celebrating the fact they got shot.
But you can't disrespect his passion.
Yeah. Well, what you're supposed to do with a guy like that, if you're opposing him, is debate him.
Right.
Have a conversation where your argument is more compelling than his.
Sure.
That's what people should be celebrating, discourse. You know, we used to do that.
Do some homework and bring it to the table.
Yeah. Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. This podcast has been a lot about violence, man.
It has, but not this kind.
No.
I'm sorry, not something so in the moment right now from someone this current.
Yeah.
That we see and are aware of daily.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those young influencers, right? This time from the right, who is all over social media, always doing these various shows and debating people and talking to people and giving speeches. And
sure.
Yeah. No one deserves this, folks. No one that has different opinions. No one deserves that.
No.
This is horrible.
No.
But I know people are going to celebrate it. Because this is a fucked up time, and people have really fallen into this trap of us against them.
But it's also going to make people not want to be as courageous or not want to be as forthright with the things they believe. It's gonna put people on guard.
It could.
It could do the opposite.
Yeah.
I get that, but there's also going to be that sort of ingrained thing now.
Mm-hmm. You're correct. Yeah.
And, you know, and just go, you know, going through the whole New York thing, I just, you know, sometimes you're, you know, there's a crowd and it's all love.
That's it for today. Got a podcast? Head over to podsummarizer.xyz and start summarizing it in seconds. See you there.